The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Hello, good morning to you, ladies and gentlemen. Richard Martin here from the Wake Up Call in a very wet and soggy Singapore. We are having the same rain that you are hearing about and causing these devastating floods. The same rain is coming to Singapore. We're getting a few flash floods, but nothing like what's going on in Thailand right now. Anyway, it's Friday, the 21st of October, and we're all getting ready for an exciting weekend, although the European situation is now postponed until next Wednesday, simply because they really don't have anything to say, and they won't have much to say on Wednesday either, but don't tell them I told you. Well, if you want to know what the early stages of an economic collapse looked like, just walk around some of the downtown areas of major cities. Today, nearly all large American cities are either flat, broke, or on the way. Oh yes, New York City and Washington, D.C., and a few others are still doing fairly well, but for most cities, economic reality is catching up with them very quickly. Right now, there are a number of major cities that are so broke that they can't even keep the streetlights operating. Parents in some areas of St. Louis are carrying golf clubs with them as they walk their kids to school in order to fend off roving packs of wild dogs. In other major U.S. cities, open-air drug markets conduct business without fear. All over the United States, cities that used to be clean and prosperous and full of hope are now being transformed into post-industrial wastelands. We may not be in Max territory yet, but it doesn't take too much imagination to see where all of this is headed. I've mentioned on previous shows how Detroit is coming apart at the seams. Well, now in many areas of the city, they can't even keep the streetlights on anymore. There simply isn't enough money. And even if there was, thieves are stealing the copper wiring out of the streetlights faster than the city can repair them. There are now sub-neighborhoods in Detroit where up to 50% of the streetlights are not functioning. Let me quote from a recent article in the Detroit News about this crisis. The war to keep the city lights on in Detroit is a serious one. Thieves, antiquated equipment, and a lack of funding have made it possible for city officials to catch up to the problem, or rather impossible. City officials estimate 15 to 20% of the 88,000 lights in the Motor City are not working. And they acknowledge that figure could be as high as 50% in some neighborhoods. End of quote. But you know, it's not just Detroit with a major problem. Over in Highland Park, Michigan, the majority of the streetlights have been repossessed because the city was not keeping up with the electricity bill. So what are the residents of Highland Park supposed to do? Are they supposed to lock themselves in their homes at night? In Fresno, California, the theft of copper wire from streetlights has become a total nightmare. At this point, The loss of copper wire and the cost of repairing the streetlights is costing Fresno about $50,000 a month. So far, approximately 2,500 streetlights have been stripped of their wiring. In St. Louis, they're having a different problem. In some of the worst areas of the city, roving packs of wild dogs are a serious threat to children that are walking to school. A recent report by the local CBS affiliate in St. Louis describes the situation this way, and I quote, Lewis Reed is sounding the alarm, quote, I've witnessed packs of dogs, 10 and 15 dogs running together, and I've seen all these dogs I'm talking about. They don't have collars, they don't have tags. These are truly wild dogs, he said. Reed says stray dogs are terrorizing the north side. Quote, it's obscene that parents have to walk their kids to school in some parts of the city with a golf club to fend off wild dogs. End of quote. Can you imagine that? They say that they're going to try to put more money into animal control efforts if they can find it. But like most major U.S. cities, St. Louis is in a financial basket case. Moving west, Las Vegas is a different kind of problem. Once a mighty symbol of American luxury and decadence, now it's a microcosm of everything that has gone wrong with the economy. The following description of the decline of Las Vegas comes from a recent article in Britain's Daily Telegraph, and I quote, But Las Vegas's days as a boom town are long gone. At 14%, unemployment is the highest in America, the national average being 9.1%. House prices have fallen 58.1% since their 2006 high, the biggest losses of anywhere in America, while according to the website RealtyTrack, which specializes in foreclosed properties, Las Vegas is the nation's foreclosure capital. Some 70% of homes in Las Vegas are thought to be underwater or in negative equity, meaning their value is worth less than the amount owed on the mortgage. While foreclosure notices have been served on 1 in 16 properties. A survey last year by the local Las Vegas Review-Journal and Channel 8 News Now found that 34% of locals would leave Las Vegas if they could find a job elsewhere or if they weren't underwater on their home loan. Well, end of quote. There's 34% of the people that might well want to come to the Richard Martin meetup group next Sunday, but of course they're on the other side of the country. Well, I remember talking to you about Las Vegas and the wake-up call over a year ago. And since then, things have got much worse for the city in many ways. Today, there are hundreds of people living in tunnels underneath the streets of Las Vegas. You can see CNN video of some of these people. But at least the tunnel people have a roof over their heads in what is now being increasingly known as Los Angeles. Homelessness is absolutely exploding. There are thousands of people living in the streets. I'm going to quote to you from a recent article by Nick Allen. In Skid Row, a grimy pocket of downtown Los Angeles, the prostrate forms of homeless people lie strewn across the pavements. The lucky ones have tents for shelter, but others make do with a sliver of cardboard for a bed and a supermarket trolley to carry their rags. At the last police count, 1,662 people live on these streets, twice as many as a year ago. And now, amid the drug addicts and the drunks, there are families who not so long ago had homes and ordinary suburban lives. End of quote. So, let's get back to this story of the famed recovery America's dear sweet politicians have been trying to force down your throats. Yes, that recovery. Weren't things supposed to be getting better? So here's a question for these hateful, ignorant monsters. Why has the number of people living on Skid Row doubled over the past year? Los Angeles, like much of California, is rapidly falling apart. Decades of very foolish policies have turned the California dream into the California nightmare. Unemployment is rampant. Crime is seemingly everywhere, and the gangs appear to be getting bolder by the day. For example, 21 machine guns were recently stolen right out of an LAPD training facility. But did you know that there are cities in California that are in even worse shape than Los Angeles? If you go east of LA about 100 miles, you come to the city of San Bernardino. 34.6% of the residents of San Bernardino are currently living below the poverty line. 34.6%. Among major U.S. cities, only Detroit has a worse poverty rate. Back on the East Coast, in the city of Camden, New Jersey, which is representative of the post-industrial hellholes that you will find all over the Mid-Atlantic region and up into New England, in an extraordinary article entitled City of Ruins, Chris Hedges did an amazing job of documenting how bad things have got in Camden. Today, it's estimated that the actual rate of unemployment in Camden is somewhere around 30 to 40%. For most young people in Camden, there are very few legitimate opportunities for a better life. So many of them have resorted to selling drugs or selling their bodies in a desperate attempt to survive. The following is a brief excerpt from City of Ruins. There are perhaps 100 open-air drug markets, most run by gangs like the Bloods, the Latin Kings, Los Nietos, and MS-13. Knots of young men in black leather jackets and baggy sweatshirts sell weed and crack to clients, many of whom drive in from the suburbs. The drug trade is one of the city's few thriving businesses. A weapon, police say, is never more than a few feet away, usually stashed behind a trash can in the grass or on a porch. End of quote. Ladies and gentlemen, the era of American exceptionalism is over. America has rejected the things that made it great. It has forsaken the truth, and now it's paying the price. At this point, America is rapidly becoming a joke to the rest of the world. You know that things are bad when headlines such as this start showing up in major international publications. America must manage its decline. Is that what Americans are going to tell their kids and grandkids? Are you going to tell them that they must manage their decline? Most Americans do realize that something is fundamentally wrong. According to a recent Time magazine poll, 81% of the American people believe that the country is on the wrong track. The cities just can't spend more money and fix all of these problems because most of them are drowning in a sea of red ink. Instead of spending more money, most of them are desperately searching for more places to cut. 72% of all U.S. cities are laying workers off this year. The federal government has been pumping massive amounts of money into state and local governments in recent years, but that cannot last much longer. As I mentioned on Monday, the federal government is overwhelmed with debt. In fact, the national debt has become so large that it threatens to collapse the entire financial system. There is absolutely no way around this. These things are as certain as the fact that I'm sitting here talking to you now. The only decision you have to make now is whether you are going to stay around babysitting this nonsense or whether you are going to take steps to leave and go somewhere else. Lately, I've been hearing comments, or rather excuses, that everywhere will be as bad as the United States, so why bother to move? give you my absolute assurance that that is not the case. It cannot be. For every debtor nation, there has to be a creditor nation or group of creditor nations. The United States used to be that nation. It is no longer. It is the debtor nation, just like Germany was in the 1920s and 30s. Germans needed to leave at that time. Most did not. They took the consequences. Well, I can offer you my meetup group next Sunday, the 30th of October, in New Brunswick, New Jersey, where you can obtain valuable information and moral support from other like-minded people. If you're in the area, I strongly suggest you go. And if you want to take this down, ladies and gentlemen, that's October the 30th at 2 p.m. in Evelyn's Restaurant, Eastern Avenue, New Brunswick. We repeat that. Evelyn's Restaurant, Eastern Avenue in New Brunswick. Lou is the moderator, and you can call him for more information at 732-599-2200. That's Lou, who will be very appreciative of your call, just to let him know you are coming, because obviously he has to arrange the tables at the restaurant. His number again is 732-599-2200. Now, it's absolutely free. Nobody will pressure you into buying anything or paying any money, other than if you want a cup of coffee. It will be the third get-together, and I urge you to give it a try. Okay, here's my info. First of all, the number to call, if you would like to call our toll-free number to talk to us here on the show. You can dial 888-874-4888. That's again my toll-free number at 888-874-4888. It should be easy. If you want to email me, please feel free to do so. My email address is rm@gfawd.com. Once again, RM for Richard Martin, GFAWD, Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design .com. RM@GFAWD.com. And my direct line in Sarasota, Florida, coming through to Singapore, no expense to your good selves, is 941-441-1682. That's my direct line if you would like to talk to me about your personal considerations away from the eyes and ears of current company. Again, the area code is 941, number is 441-1682. Okay, I'm going to play you a very short clip now, or two clips actually, from an interview between Bill Black, hosted by Dylan Rattigan. I'm sure many of you have heard of him. He's a very progressive host on the television these days, on MSNBC. Bill Black I have mentioned and quoted and played many, many times. I can't play him enough. He is one of the few people who really set it as it is, with a lot of credibility. He's Associate Professor of Economics and Law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He was a director of the Federal Home Loan Board and was in charge of the prosecutions of the S&L crisis back in the 80s, prosecuting is up to, I think, about 1,000 people. And here he is, ladies and gentlemen, talking to Dylan Rattigan, Bill Black.
Well, let me bring your two comments together, because we're speaking here from the heartland of the United States, and the most prominent person in finance in Kansas City, a rock rib conservative Republican, used the exact phrase. He said, "We put the Treasury Secretary up for auction, and lately Goldman Sachs has been the highest bidder." So this is not a left-right. It's not Republican-Democrat. It's honest folks against the elite frauds who now cheat with impunity. And the biggest victims of those frauds, of course, are the homeowners, but the second biggest victims are the honest bankers, the ones that can't compete with the frauds.
If you were to be put in a situation, which I honestly think a lot of folks would like to see you in, where you could advocate a path to begin resolution to fix some of this, which obviously the left-right political paradigm is not equipped to do, how would you advise the rest of us?
Well, the first thing is get rid of the systemically dangerous institutions. These are the 20 biggest banks that the administration and the last administration told us. As soon as the next one goes down, there's going to be another global crisis. Well, there's nobody serious who doesn't actually work for one of those banks who believes they're an efficient size. In other words, they're way too big. If we shrink them, we make them more efficient. We dramatically reduce the risk of the next crisis, and we produce greater employment and less fraud. That's a win-win-win. We need to do that first. The second thing is you need to fire Geithner, you need to fire Holder, and you need to demand Bernanke's resignation. And you need to replace them with people that will actually enforce the laws for the 99. Well, for technical reasons, you just add your burden of proof when you do that. But we can prosecute them under the existing fraud laws for very conventional fraud. Look, the FBI warned over 7 years ago that there was an epidemic of mortgage fraud and predicted that it would cause an economic crisis. There's no excuse. We've had over 7 years to deal with open frauds. Only about a month ago, the Federal Housing Finance Administration filed fraud complaints, civil ones, against 17 of the largest banks in the world, in which it said there is a paper trail that demonstrates the fraudulent intent of these banks. Well, where is the Justice Department? And for that matter, where's Paul Krugman, who can't be bothered to use the F word? This is the five-letter F word you can use in public. It's called fraud. And until the economists get over their silly tribal taboo against using the word fraud and actually supporting us in prosecuting the frauds, we're never going to make progress.
David, your last word.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, it speaks for itself as always. You know, he is very lucid and coherent, and he makes it very clear where we come from and where we need to go. So I will bring you more information from Bill Black as it becomes available, but there are a few people who are really able to bring the subject into clear focus in the way that he does. So anything he writes, any opportunity that you have to listen to him or watch him, don't hesitate. He has the right information. Okay, we have a caller. And the caller is, if I can just scroll my way back up here a little bit, Trudy in New York, who would like to know about buying a house in Westchester. Hello, Trudy. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thanks for having me on the show. I wanted to know what your opinion was on buying a house. We've recently sold our apartment. We've been looking for a while, actually trying to sell for a while, and we've finally done so, and we're about to buy a house. And I am very worried to invest house money, basically, into this market again. And my husband is not on the same page with me, so I'm wondering what you think about that, buying a house in Westchester now.
First of all, let me say, Trudy, the division of opinion in the household is pretty classic. The lady of the house is always reticent and hesitant, and the gentleman is always rearing to go. So this is no news to me. And it is, however, in my opinion, your responsibility to convince him that there is a tremendous amount of downside to go in housing, Judy, and I'm talking about particularly Westchester County, Long Island, Brooklyn. I mean, in fact, Manhattan, anywhere in the New York area, which basically is still benefiting from the Wall Street success story, which is about to end. Tens of thousands of people, if not hundreds of thousands, are about to be laid off on Wall Street. This is going to take its toll on property values all over the New York area. As always, I can't prove this to you. I can't give you proof that you can sort of slam down in front of your husband's eyes. You've just got to use your sense of logic, your sense of coherence about these matters. And take out the bias, and that you will see, apart from anything else, that there are record numbers of what they call shadow inventory of houses which have not yet been put onto the market by the banks because they're afraid that they will swamp the market in the price of houses. The housing market in all its elements is, as they say, in the toilet. I mean, basically, there isn't any... there's no bright spark in sight. There's no light at the end of any tunnel. I don't even think they know where the tunnel is, let alone the light. The answer is no, no, and no, Trudy. Sorry.
All right, thank you. Do you think renting is a better idea?
Yes. Well, you've got to do one or the other, haven't you? And if
right.
you want to join the Occupy people, you could just go down and spend your time with, in Zuccotti Park. That's a third alternative. But failing that, yep, renting is the way to go.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much, Trudy.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Well, we are, Matt, we're 2 minutes away here. I think we'll take our break right now, and then I will talk to you in a little bit more detail about the unemployment situation and how bad I think it's going to get. So let's go to break, and I'll be right back. Okay, we are back. And as I said, I'd like to just make a couple of comments here about the unemployment situation. You may have heard Gap will close 189 stores in the U.S. and expand in China. Walmart plans smaller stores. Lowe's announced the other day that it will close 20 stores, affecting 1,950 employees. Best Buy plans to reduce square footage by 10%. Regional and strip mall vacancies are at record highs already. How many trucking jobs will that cost? How many manufacturing jobs? Note the implications on commercial real estate rents and prices. Earlier this week, Citigroup set aside lower reserves for losses. What a farce. In July, as financial sector layoffs mounted, a top executive search firm estimated as many as 80,000 jobs might go in this coming round of financial layoffs. Richard Stein of Caldwell Partners said, "This is kind of like the beginning of a tsunami. You don't get it in one go. It sort of comes in shock, short waves," end of quote. The securities industry still employs about 800,000 people nationwide, according to the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association. Did you know that only 7.8% fewer than the all-time high, and roughly the same as in 2006, when Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers still roamed the earth? It isn't a stretch to think that employment could fall to 2003 levels, meaning another 50,000 job cuts. Judy, take note. And in a worst-case scenario, the decline could feel like a throwback to pre-tech bubble days, when the industry employed 100,000 fewer people than at the end of March. These jobs will not come back for decades, if ever. The mall vacancy number just hit a new all-time high. During the third quarter, vacancies at regional and super-regional malls rose to 9.4% from 8.8% a year earlier and 9.3% in the second quarter, according to the New York-based property research company Reis. This was the highest since data was compiled in 2000. So where does anyone think these new jobs are going to come from? Not housing, not financials, not government, hopefully, not commercial real estate, and certainly not retail sales. You know, when I talk of the importance of leaving the country if you are unemployed, you don't stand a statistical chance of getting employed again in the United States. So what's the solution? First of all, government is not the answer, nor are Keynesian makeshift work programs that will hire a few union workers at monstrous costs fixing little. The country needs to fix structural problems. That means scrapping Davis-Bacon and prevailing wage laws, getting rid of poisonous public union collective bargaining agreements, lowering benefits of public unions that act as a drain on cities, states, and municipalities, and expanding education opportunities via accredited low-cost online schools. Of course, most importantly, military spending should be cut by at least half, and probably by about 80%. All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, let us take a few emails which come our way from time to time. One is from Thor Dockweiler in Los Angeles, who says, "Dear Richard, we live with a zombie government. It persecutes like zombie ghosts. It overregulates the Second Amendment, the very being of which would reduce the increasing crime we now see. Zombie authorities killed the animals, just like zombies. They have no brains. They took the easy route, kill, kill, kill. Too much trouble to have to think to round them up. All done on a rainy day when the animals would have been more relaxed trying to shelter from the rain. Talk about being lazy. The same technique was done with the American Indians back in time, as is still being done now in our foreign entanglements. I would have been more pleased if a nest of zombie politicians had been taken out." Well, thank you for Doc Weiler from Los Angeles. Pithy and certainly to the point. Here's something I found in Zero Hedge, which I thought you should know. One place where nominal and real income data can absolutely not be fudged is the Social Security Average Wage Index, based on withholding data reported by employers, particularly the median wage, whose nominal change can then be extrapolated in real terms using CPI to create a chained series. And here is where things get messy, as John Lohman demonstrates. Real income based on median wages dropped in real terms by 1.2%, the biggest year-over-year slide in over 20 years of data. What we are seeing is a perfect storm of horrendous economic data on almost all fronts. Manufacturing costs are up. Essential basic goods have skyrocketed in price over the last 3 years. And more people are left unemployed every single month than the month before. The economic situation of this nation is dire. We are well outside short-term cyclical downturn territory here. There will be no meaningful growth 18 months from now, as this is not a recession. We're talking deep depression levels of economic inactivity that may potentially span decades. Right. Well, an email from Sarita, who wrote in saying, "Hi, Richard. Heard you earlier today on your regular show and later this afternoon on the October the 3rd archived program. Want you to know that I agree with Peter, who called in to say that for many of us to call you and take up any of your valuable minutes is simply not a consideration. I value so very much all the information you give, and it seems selfish to use up that time when one can write to you instead. Recently, a friend visited me from Florida. She is a Cuban lady who came to this country after living the change in Cuba. It was most interesting to listen to how frightened she is at what is happening in this country. Her views are apparently widespread in the Cuban community in Florida. What happened in Cuba is slowly but surely happening here. She recalled how everyone thought Fidel was a hero and everyone loved him and opened their doors and hearts to him and told him their home was his home. She pointed out that Cubans already have experienced the change. While Americans are asleep and may one day find themselves going through that change and not knowing what happened. It was most interesting to hear her describe the communist takeover from a personal experience. As a child in school, she recalled being sent home since the school had to be closed because children had to go to public schools and not private ones. One of the things that upset her most is the way we are told constantly, if you see something, say something. She said this happened in Cuba and then escalated to having everyone mistrusting their friends and family. Thank you again for all you teachers. Listening to you talk of the economist Kurt Riechenbecher was fascinating. We'll read more about him. I'm looking forward to being with the meetup group on October the 30th. Regards, Sarita. Well, thank you for that, Sarita. Very illuminating and worthwhile explanation. Pat wrote in saying, I want to propose that fiat currency can work and has worked only when it is not debt-based. The money stick was around in England for some 700 years. We've had highly successful debt-free fiat currencies in America as well. The reason they failed here was, number one, because the British started counterfeiting it, and later the international banks fought very heavily against it. But a correctly maintained debt-free fiat currency can work very well. Pat. Well, yes, Pat. Theoretically, you're right. It's like saying, theoretically, if we all leave our doors open and our cars unlocked with the keys in the ignition, we should still find our homes intact and our cars in place the following morning. Unfortunately, life doesn't work like that, Pat. The very purpose of a fiat currency is to abuse it. That's why it exists. That's why the dollar was taken away from the gold standard. It wasn't just a cosmetic operation. It was indeed so that they could print more of it. And that's what a fiat currency is all about. A fiat currency almost, though not by definition, but almost by definition, states that it is a currency whose value does not need to be pegged and can be printed at any time. So what you say is theoretically very true, Pat, but in reality, it sort of simply isn't going to happen. But anyway, thank you for your email, and certainly it brought up an interesting conundrum. Okay, we have an email from Patrick Winchester, who says, well, you continue to illustrate why I listen to you. I may not always agree, but you keep it real, that's for sure. I'm extremely glad that you stand up for the fact that peak oil is a manufactured fraud to induce artificial scarcity and raise prices. You get complaints about hydrofracking all the time just because Gary now really pushed against it, and I may not be in favor of it either. But you are just making economic points, I understand. Gary does good political research, but the radical enviro stuff gets difficult sometimes, and your show is a show that I can stand because I am very glad that the network doesn't censor you because you disagree with the majority. The fraudulent carbon market and that con artist Al Gore might be an interesting topic of discussion, as it is another fraudulent debt-based market bubble that will eventually destroy economies and kill people through poverty. But of course, you know, the very elite say that the Earth is overpopulated, and so anything that reduces population is a good thing. It's disgusting. You talk about the deindustrialization of America, but you must see that it is the global plan to turn our country into a third world slave hole. The UN Environmental Council talks about the industrializing or the deindustrializing of the West being the goal, and as I said, population reduction is pushed as a major issue. China gets all the industrial business because they impose eugenics laws, forced family planning. This is the end goal and must be understood to fully understand why the things that are happening are happening. On my blog, I did two pieces dealing with this mindset and the real environmental issues for that face living things on Earth. They are the only two articles there right now if you care to check them out. And it's decoding propaganda, that's all one word, decodingpropaganda.blogspot.com. Once more, let me give you Patrick's blog. You might want to give it a look. It's decodingpropaganda.blogspot.com. Your point on the Friday show this week about prices and wages is something that leftists really don't understand. People have got to get a basic grounding in economic theories and why Marxist communism leads to totalitarian police states and eventual collapse. I've written a rather lengthy review of the possibilities of a Ron Paul presidency. Included in the piece is a link to your discussion on the issuance of currency and a discussion that I put forth explaining a little bit more about the idea behind my production-based economy. That idea will probably have to be fleshed out in the book, as it is a topic that requires deep discussion. I bring it up, however, because I make exactly the same point in the piece about wages and prices. Thank you very much. Best regards, Patrick. We appreciate that very much, Patrick. That was useful to know. Well, Karl Marx oversold socialism, but he was right in claiming that globalization, unfettered financial capitalism, and redistribution of income and wealth from labor to capital could lead capitalism to self-destruct. As he argued, unregulated capitalism can lead to regular bouts of overcapacity, underconsumption, and the recurrence of destructive financial crises fueled by credit bubbles and asset price booms and busts. Even before the Great Depression, Europe's enlightened bourgeois classes recognized that in order to avoid revolution, workers' rights needed to be protected, wage and labor conditions improved, and a welfare state created to redistribute wealth and finance public goods, education, healthcare, and a social safety net. The push towards a modern welfare state accelerated after the Great Depression, when the state took on the responsibility for macroeconomic stabilization, a role that required the maintenance of a large middle class by widening the provision of public goods through progressive taxation of incomes and wealth, and fostering economic opportunity for all. Thus, the rise of the social welfare state was a response to the threat of popular revolutions, socialism, and communism as the frequency and severity of economic and financial crises increased. 3 decades of relative social and economic stability then ensued, from the late 1940s until the mid-1970s, a period when inequality fell sharply and median incomes grew rapidly. Some of the lessons about the need for prudential regulation of the financial system were lost in the Reagan-Thatcher era, when the appetite for massive deregulation was created in part by the flaws in Europe's social welfare model. Those flaws were reflected in yawning fiscal deficits, regulatory overkill, and the lack of economic dynamism that led to sclerotic growth and then to the Eurozone's sovereign debt crisis that we have right now. But the laissez-faire Anglo-Saxon model has also now failed miserably. To stabilize market-oriented economies requires a return to the right balance between markets and provision of public goods. That means moving away from both the Anglo-Saxon model of unregulated markets and the continental European model of deficit-driven welfare states. Even an alternative Asian growth model, if there really is one, hasn't prevented a rise in inequality in China, India, and elsewhere. Any economic model that does not properly address inequality will eventually face a crisis of legitimacy. Unless the relative economic roles of the market and the state are rebalanced, the protests of 2011 will become more severe, with social and political instability eventually harming long-term economic growth and welfare. And that's really where we stand today, ladies and gentlemen. There's no getting away from it. Well, looking at the earnings that have been coming out in recent days, frankly, as if we needed more accounting tricks, Citibank reported earnings yesterday, claiming big gains by reporting a rather big $1.9 billion one-time gain based on how it reevaluated its own debt. And I quote, third quarter revenues included a $1.9 billion credit valuation adjustment, that's a CVA, reflecting the widening of Citigroup's credit spreads during the third quarter. Excluding CVA, third quarter 2011 revenues were $18.9 billion, 8% below the prior year period and 8% below the second quarter 2011. So CVA increased reported third quarter earnings by 39 cents a share. I am clearly not the only one who sees this. Here's an excerpt from October the 17th edition of Barron's Up and Down Wall Street by Randy Forsyth. Who says accountants don't have a sense of humor? The rules for bank earnings are as absurd as anything Monty Python ever came up with. But to the market, they're pretty much an unfunny joke. And that's exactly what we have today, ladies and gentlemen. We have companies who are just basically pulling out of a hat any piece of information they possibly can to goose their earnings and to lie and to force their stock price up for their own very good reasons. One of these days, I'm assuming that someone like Bill Black will come along and lead the prosecution of all these people, but I don't have any high hopes right now. The world is simply not in a mood to look into this. Well, on Tuesday we learned that Bank of America is joining into the shell game of Citigroup, I've just mentioned, and JP Morgan, which are already playing. Bank of America illegally has moved its bad assets into a shell company. And this game is illegal, ladies and gentlemen. It is fraud. It always has been until just recently when the government has given their approval to do so because, you know, they don't want their biggest financial supporters to go under. That would be bad for the economy. Good for the economy in my book, frankly. 3 years after taxpayer rescued some of the biggest U.S. lenders, regulators are grappling with how to protect FDIC-insured bank accounts from risks generated by investment banking operations. Bank of America, which got a $45 billion bailout during the financial crisis, had $1.04 trillion in deposits as of mid-year, ranking it second among U.S. firms. And I quote from Bill Black, who says, the concern is that there is always an enormous temptation to dump the losers on the insured institution. We should have fairly tight restrictions on that. End of quote. You see, ladies and gentlemen, what the banks are doing is dumping bad assets, not only into completely new shell corporations, but they're dumping them into the biggest shell dumping grounds of them all, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. The banks are making bad loans with money from nothing, then moving the garbage off their books to appear healthy themselves while putting the taxpayer on the hook for their mistakes. But we already know that, don't we? What many are overlooking is that the banks, meanwhile, have stuffed their coffers full of excess reserves, so-called, to the tune of $1.6 trillion. That's the money that was given to them by the Federal Reserves on the basis of which the Federal Reserve is paying them interest courtesy the taxpayer. In September 2008, Hank Paulson, former Goldman Sachs CEO and then Treasury Secretary, turned chief criminal of the United States. He wanted and then got the Fed to begin paying the banks for any excess reserves that they hold. And again, where does the money to come to pay them come from? Well, you, ladies and gentlemen, yes, the taxpayer. And just look at the excess reserves today. Now, let's get a few things straight about these $1.6 trillion that are just sitting there with you paying the bank's interest. The banks have never had any real reserves. They have generated so much debt that they have saturated the planet. But because they were so successful at saturating the planet, they have destroyed their own lending model. There are now so few qualified borrowers because of saturation that they have a difficult time just taking in deposits and then lending at a profit. Besides, why pay depositors their pittance of 0.25% when they can make money from nothing to lend anyway and then offload their horror show onto Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae and now the other shell corporations? Talk about broken. The money system and the rule of law in the United States are so far gone, it's not even funny. And what's more, just turn on the television and you'll see these so-called analysts proclaiming that there's never been a better time to own bank stocks. They're cheap. The only problem is that they're nothing but giant leverage and fraud baskets and that the winds of change are about to sweep clean. Many people worry about that $1.6 trillion in excess reserves. They worry that it's going to come flooding into the economy at some point and cause hyperinflation. Well, let's examine what a bank really can do with all that money. They can't lend it because they saturated everyone with debt already, and the populace can't service still more debt. That's the problem. But what they could do is use it to buy up cheap assets and strip the poor saps of America of the rest of their belongings. But if they did that, then they may not be properly capitalized. So what are poor, poor banks supposed to do? Well, over the last 2 years, I've warned repeatedly about the dangers to American property rights caused by massive bank fraud. A deadly combination of MERS, robo-signing, and illegal shortcuts have created a horrific situation. A bedrock of American society, the ability for the owner of a piece of real estate to confidently convey that property, along with all associated property rights, is now in danger. It was the inevitable result of the frauds that too many state attorneys general seemed unwilling to prosecute. Well, as I'm sure you've seen the end results of that massive fraud and the state's refusal to hold the wrongdoers accountable, is simply this. And I quote, the highest court in Massachusetts ruled that a homeowner who bought a foreclosure that hadn't been properly conducted by the foreclosing bank in 2006 didn't have legal ownership of the property. The decision by the Supreme Judicial Court casts a cloud over the legal ownership of any properties in Massachusetts where banks didn't properly convey title when foreclosing. The problem has gained attention nationwide because of banks' use of robo-signing and other dubious practices that may have broken the chains of title on foreclosures. The case follows a previous state court decision that voided a foreclosure when banks couldn't prove that they owned mortgages when they initiated foreclosure proceedings. End of quote. The rule of law is yet another bedrock foundation of the nation. It seems to get ignored when the criminals involved received billions in bipartisan bailout money. The line of BS being used on states' attorneys general is that we risk an economic crisis if we prosecute these people. The people who claim that fail to realize that the opposite is true. The protests at Occupy Wall Street and the negative sentiment, the general economic angst, traces itself to the belief that there is no justice, that senior bankers have got away with economic murder, and that we have a two-tiered criminal system, one for the rich and one for the poor. Last Wednesday's New York Times notes the gloom that has descended over consumers, and they suggest it may be caused by home prices. I think they're wrong. I think this sort of generalized rage and frustration comes about when people realize the institutions they have trusted have betrayed them. Humans deal with financial losses in a very specific way, and it's not fury. This is about a fundamental breakdown of the role of government, courts, and leadership in the nation. And it all traces back to the bailouts of reckless bankers and the refusal to hold them in any way accountable. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is exactly what Occupy Wall Street is all about. And so far, I think they're doing well. They have steadfastly refused to get involved with any political party or any grouping of political persuasions of one sort or another. And as long as they stay that way, they will be the bane of all the pundits and the media and the politicians who are trying to pinhole them and basically accuse them of one thing or another. They cannot do that if they are independent. I think they know it, and I think they've got good instincts, and I hope for their sake that they continue to follow them. Well, all right, ladies and gentlemen, that brings us to the end of another show. This is Richard Martin, and I wish you all a wonderful weekend. Take care. I'll be back with you 10 a.m. sharp Monday morning. Until then, bye-bye for now.